From 89.7 WUWM Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Teich. Today on the show, why the State of the Union address can still be important in the age of Twitter and the 24-hour news cycle.
A good speech will ask something of its audience, and the ask is kind of built in the State of the Union, but also you can ask things of the American people.
Later, our I'm an American series continues with a Hmong woman's identity story.
Plus, a Cedarburg teacher wins a national award for her geometry lesson, but her students learn more than math.
So with these projects, students are not just sitting at their desks, but they're also collaborating with each other.
And our Fit for You segment explains how people can get hurt when they exercise outdoors in cold weather.
Lack of preparation in terms of clothing is probably one of the biggest factors that will predispose people to that type of injury.
Lake Effect is next, after the news. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Thanks for joining us today. I'm Mitch Teich.
And I'm Bonnie North. Millions of Americans will tune in this evening as President Trump gives his State of the Union address to a joint session of Congress. The speech was delayed after Speaker of the House Nancy Pelosi rescinded the official invitation to the president during the partial government shutdown.
But in an era in which the president can't address Congress or the American people from his smartphone, is the speech even necessary? It's a question that's weighed on the mind of Marquette University political science professor Julia Azari, who joins us on the line from D.C. Welcome back to the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
So you have written about the State of the Union address as kind of a norm. Why is the State of the Union necessary? Why is it a norm in 2019?
So great question. I think those are maybe slightly different questions. I think that it's evolved as a norm over time, and it just kind of has the weight of history and time carried with it. The State of the Union address, the Constitution is very vague about what it is the president should tell Congress about the State of the Union and propose legislation or propose action for them to take. Congress, of course, proposes the legislation. And then that turned into first an oral address, then Thomas Jefferson turned it into a written tradition. Woodrow Wilson turned it back into delivering the address in person to Congress, and with the advent of television, it's kind of become this more public event. That's how the norm, in a nutshell, has evolved. And so now it's just part of the presidency. It's something the president just does. One of the arguments that I have made in a variety of contexts is that these kinds of rituals are important to give a sense of continuity to the presidency and to illustrate that it's an office that is bigger than any one occupant. I think it's also important in this particular case, a lot of presidential speeches don't really involve Congress. Increasingly, it's this kind of direct relationship between the president and the electorate. And it's kind of nice for people to see that Congress is a co-equal branch too, and to see them interact and react to the president, even if it's very partisan, even if we can predict it, even if nothing earth-shattering happens, I think it's good to be reminded that presidential kind of legislative agenda setting isn't just about the president and the people. There's this other branch too.
In recent years, do you feel like is the president, Donald Trump or whoever, really addressing the Congress, or is he addressing the American people with Congress in the room?
So I think that's an important distinction, and I do think that television has made that more complicated. I also think with Trump, his first address to a joint session of Congress in 2017, the other tradition is not the State of the Union if they haven't been in office for a year, whatever. It's the format. We all know the format.
If it walks like a duck and talks like a duck.
Right, exactly. But if we want to be pedantic, that's fine. I'll be pedantic. But I wrote a piece about this on my blog on the Mistress of Faction about after the address, noting that Trump really hadn't asked a lot of either the American people or Congress. The typical format in the State of the Union, even when it's before Trump, it was really the president addressing the country with Congress in the room. was, you know, I'm asking Congress to move on this. I'm asking Congress for legislation. Sometimes it would be very specific, you know, often not as specific. Trump didn't really do any of that. You know, a good speech will ask something of its audience, and the ask is kind of built in the State of the Union, but also you can ask things of the American people about, you know, you can ask them, call your representatives. That's pretty heavy-handed. You can do it. You can ask people to be, you know, to be more civically engaged, whatever. It's not really a feature of Trump's rhetoric. I think that that's useful, though, to have that to highlight, right, to compare. That here is where all these different presidents across different partisan affiliations and issue stances and political styles all asked Congress to do this thing, and Trump didn't. You know, as we, I think one of the big points of conversation in contemporary politics is just how exceptional and out of the norm is Trump and in what ways. And anytime he is doing something in a kind of traditional format where other presidents have done a similar thing, we have a really nice point of comparison where people can think for themselves about how unusual is this president and how important is that? If it's a different what he's doing, how important is that to me? Those are the kinds of questions, and you know, citizens can make decisions with good information.
The other unusual aspect to the 2019 State of the Union is that it is happening later than it was scheduled to, because the president was disinvited by Speaker Pelosi during the government shutdown. Even though it has been resolved to the degree that the speech is happening, what do you think is the legacy of the fight over the State of the Union between the president and the Speaker of the House?
So we will see. Time will tell. I think on the one hand, it raises the stakes of a partisan conflict. And we could potentially imagine a world in which this becomes a typical tactic when the Speaker of the House and the president are from different parties, that they have this haggling over when and under what conditions the president is invited. You know, 35-day shutdown is a pretty exceptional circumstance, but you can imagine that might extend to other types of situations, and that might be the kind of partisan conflict that people wouldn't necessarily want to see escalated. On the other hand, I think what this did was it allowed Pelosi to reassert prerogative as a co-equal branch of government. That this isn't just about the president. You know, it's this kind of norm, it's pro forma. We expect that Congress will invite the president to come speak. And for Pelosi saying, oh, look, this is not automatic. You will come speak when we invite you, and not under these circumstances, did rub people the wrong way, but also does highlight the fact that many of our political norms involve deference, and often that deference is to a strong and expansive presidency, and that may not be the best thing.
Well, and you write in your piece for 538 that for as many norms as President Trump has gone against by disinviting the president, Nancy Pelosi also violated a norm as well.
Mm-hmm. I think this is the thing about norms is that informal practices are constantly evolving. And a lot of things that we consider in retrospect to be great leadership are norm violations. I also wrote a piece on 538 about FDR that went pretty deeply into this, and the norm violation that was his running for third and fourth term, the way that he pushed back on the court, these kinds of practices, you know, those in retrospect are viewed by many people as great leadership, but often that leadership involves really pushing back on established practices. And, you know, that's not to say that that's always the case. And I think that there are obviously instances in which politicians violate norms that are very concerning, but it's the content of those norms and the way in which they're working for contemporary politics that matters. And so I don't think we should always take norms at face value.
Well, and you make the point, I guess, that that violating norms can really protect democratic values, that a Democrat with a small D, but in the end, democracy can come out stronger for this.
That is kind of my view, is that sometimes norms evolve that are not serving small D democracy in a given moment, and that if the choice is between violating the standard practice or ruffling some feathers and protecting a deeper and more cherished principle, that's why you have principles, is to get you through difficult situations. And I think it's very important to hold the distinction between the two.
So it seems safe to say that that a lot of us will be watching the 2019 State of the Union with a great deal of, I don't know, is curiosity the right word, or mild apprehension? What kind of attitude do you bring to the 2019 State of the Union?
Well, I will be live blogging it on 538. So mostly my main attitude to watching these is something. What is the right word for when you're writing in real time on the internet? Is sort of over-caffeinated panic. I'll be looking a lot for the issue content. I will be looking for how much the president really hammers on contentious social issues that have been in the news, what he says about immigration, as well as the ways in which he occupies some more standard speech territory, which he has done in the joint session addresses in the past. I'll really be looking at that. This is the first one. So I'll be looking at, you know, how does this stack up to the first address that other presidents have given to a divided government? And I'll be looking for whether there's a change in tone now that the Democrats control the House.
Well, Julia Azari, we will we'll be watching and we'll be reading. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me.
Julia Azari is a political science professor at Marquette University. This semester, she's also a distinguished visiting scholar at the Kluge Center at the Library of Congress. You'll find a link to her recent article for the website 538 at WUWM.com.
We will take a quick break now, and then our series on what it means to be an American continues on Lake Effect from Milwaukee's NPR. We're back with more of Lake Effect. I'm Mitch Teich.
And I'm Bonnie North. When you ask someone what it means to be an American, you'll likely get as many different answers for every person you ask. And that is the premise behind WUWM's I'm an American series.
Because there is a renewed national dialogue going on about what makes someone American, the series explores the American identities of people of color from various religious and ethnic backgrounds who live in our community.
Today, WUWM's race and ethnicity reporter Taryn Powell speaks with Ami Vang of the Hmong American Women's Association about learning her family's history in this country.
It's interesting because I'm still learning a lot about this as part of my identity as an adult. But growing up, I had to go through the public school system learning about the Vietnam War with no mention of refugees and Hmong people. And so in the late 70s, we were part of, I want to say, the first wave of refugees that came to the United States because of our involvement with the Vietnam War. And so I've had to learn a lot of this part of American history is that was the reason why Hmong people were displaced and then also dispersed to other parts of the country. But my family was fortunate enough to come to the United States. And so we had, in the late 70s, a lot of church faith-based organizations that sponsored a lot of Hmong families that came. And so we came to Iowa in 1980. And so because we were placed in a refugee camp and that was where I was born, but my parents knew that that wasn't the life for them. And so in order to survive, they saw an opportunity and they came to the United States. And that piece of history is very relevant for a lot of people my generation. It's very common for people to share that piece, but they knew that we came to the United States to be able to thrive and survive. But a lot of that I had to learn much later as an adult because my parents never really talked about that sorrow and that trauma that they carried and wanted to survive and what that looked like for their kids.
So I understand that you were a baby when your family came to the U.S., days old, actually. Your family lived in Iowa for a couple years, and then you all moved to Wisconsin. Describe what it was like for you growing up.
I had to, you know, go through the public school system, learn English, and then, you know, being the oldest, I naturally just helped my parents interpret, go to their doctor's appointments, and then read their mail, and just learning to navigate what that American culture was. And so I've had to almost kind of unlearn everything that I've learned and to really know up our history through the voices of like my mom and my dad and my uncles and my aunties. And it was hard for me as a young person to identify like who I was because I didn't know what American meant. And then I also didn't know what Hmong meant other than I knew that I looked different. I spoke a different language. We ate different food. And there was a time where I really just wanted to be blended in and not be noticed, and here having my folks struggle and putting food on the table and making sure that we had everything that we had to be successful. And in their eyes, a lot of that was education.
Talk a little bit more about being a kid and having the responsibility of bridging that language barrier for your parents. Because I don't think people really consider the extent of that kind of pressure on a child. And not to say that your parents pressured you, but it is some sort of pressure on a kid.
Yeah, so I don't think my parents like actually asked me. I just gravitated to, because I spoke the language, because I learned it in schools, and my parents to this day, you know, when I go home, I still, you know, catch up on their mail, making sure that they're paying all their bills. And so I think naturally I like to do that, but I just felt that it was the right thing to do. And that's what I want to do with people, is informing them of, you know, whether it's their rights or educating them so that they can make an informed decision. And so, yeah, I just naturally just made sure that they were comfortable and that they were aware of, you know, what the law was, or, you know, what this piece of mail meant, and making sure that the bills were paid on time, and just teaching them how to spell correctly so that they could write checks. And a lot of that was helpful for me as an adult, because a part of me was that I was forced to grow up. And I'm not, you know, that's not anything negative, but that's basically just an observation of my childhood was different than, you know, an average child who was maybe white and was born here. But my experiences are a little bit different, basically because we had to grow up in a different country and learn what the way was here in the States.
So how would you define your identity?
I identify as Hmong. I speak Hmong as well. And so that is a huge part of my identity. And that's what I do today. Is my professional career is the choice to give back to my community. And so that's who I am.
In our first encounter, I mentioned to you that I was not familiar with the Hmong culture. And I said I felt like that could be the case with many people. So in your experience, what are some of the misconceptions people have about Hmong people or the Hmong culture that you've come across?
Growing up in a very rural, white community, people couldn't tell if I was Chinese or Korean. You know, I think when you think of the Asian umbrella, there's so many other sub-ethnicities. And that's typical. But I think when Wisconsin, Minnesota, and California having large concentrations among people, more and more people or Wisconsinites are knowing a little bit more about Hmong people. And then also there's always the stigma, or I think prejudices, that we're here really to just kind of take free services. Mm-hmm. And I think that is very true of people of color communities, and also people who identify as refugees or immigrants. And like when I look at my parents, they are some of the hardest people that I know. And they, to this day, my mom being in her early 60s, she works two jobs, and all she's known is, you know, very blue collar factory related jobs. And she knows that these are jobs that she has to work hard so that she can continue to pay the bills and save a little bit of money. But I think that whole misconception of that, you know, certain groups of people are here really to take jobs away, or that they don't work hard enough, or that we're really here to bank on free services, it's just a very unfortunate, distorted view. Because, I mean, I can tell you that my parents and my family has worked really hard to be where we are. Sometimes people see me and they don't think that I'm maybe competent, because A, even in my Hmong community, I'm female, and so I may not have, you know, all of the knowledge, or that I'm just a young, too independent of a female who may have too much of an opinion. Sometimes people assume that I'm a different race, and so I may not understand. But I think, you know, those are just some of my general experiences of what I would view, that people may view as us as negative.
Have you ever tried to work against that to educate people?
I try. You know, I mean, if people want to learn about who I am as a person or the work that I do, or, you know, if I want to, or if they want to learn more about Hmong people, I try to give them resources. It's not my place to force them.
So how often does race and ethnicity come up in your daily life?
Being a person of color and also being female, I'm always very mindful of who I am. And so it comes up on a daily basis. It comes up in a lot of the work that we do, most specifically because we are a direct service organization. And what that means is we provide services to our clients who identify as Hmong, identify as Southeast Asian, that also speak our language. And so it's an everyday piece because that's who I am. That's an identity piece. And most currently, I can't say this without tying what is happening around the world and most specifically around the nation with our current administration. I don't know how that's just my experience, is that, you know, I have to worry about people that are undocumented, because that's just a thing. We work with people, a lot of our communities that are still have refugee status, that are in this country several years, that are in transition of getting their citizenship. And so that's a very, very real theme that we work with and that we come across.
I want to go back to earlier in our conversation where you said that as a child, you didn't know what it meant to be American or what it meant to be Hmong. How do you feel now?
That is a really good question. It's up to the individual. I think that's the beautiful part, is that it's ultimately on the individual to determine who they are as a person and what their purpose is in life. And for me, I feel like my purpose is really to give back. And so the first step for me was identity, and who am I as a human being? And then also, who am I in terms of my community? I feel, as an adult today, I feel pretty good in who I am. And I think I'm less stuck on identifying a label, and it's more about what is it that I do as a person. And a lot of that is tied to the passion of social justice, advocacy, and just taking care of my people.
Ami Vang of the Hmong American Women's Association sharing her story of her American identity. WUWM's I'm an American series will be featured throughout the year.
We'll take another break now, and then a geometry teacher connects the dots between what goes on in her class and the broader skills that her students will need when they join the workforce. You're listening to Lake Effect from WUWM.
Lake Effect continues on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Bonnie North. A lot of us probably think back on our days in high school math classes and puzzle how we're using our algebra or geometry or calculus lessons in our lives today. The chances are good, though, that students of at least one teacher at Cedarburg High School should be able to do the math 10 or 15 years from now.
Tomorrow in New York, geometry teacher Elizabeth Moslick will receive the 2018 Rosenthal Prize for Innovation in Math Teaching at the National Museum of Mathematics. The prize, which comes with a $25,000 reward, honors a geometry lesson she developed called Dartboard. And while math is at the heart of the lesson, Moslick says the skills her students are learning extend well beyond those they'll need to pass her finals. Moslick joins us in the studio now to explain. Welcome to the program. Thanks for being here.
Thank you so much for having me.
So, first of all, congratulations on your award. What were you setting out to do when you designed this Dartboard lesson?
Well, it's been a six-year process. Started 6 years ago with another colleague of mine. And over the 6 years, I've made a lot of changes, especially 2 years ago, incorporating technology. So it has about a sixth of the original project, and the rest is my originals based on issues we've seen in the classroom and things I wanted to tweak with it.
Okay. Well, so flashback 6 years. What were lessons along these lines like? And so what was the deficiency you set out to correct?
So 6 years ago, we started to have a project for every quarter in geometry. It was a Cedarburg High School goal. And so my other colleague, Nikki Donahue, and I decided to have a probability project, and she found something online, and so we decided to make it work for our students.
Now, I was thinking back to my high school days, which were a few years ago, we'll say, and probability seemed to come up in statistics. I didn't see it necessarily. I didn't remember it anyway as being on the agenda for geometry.
So we have a geometric probability unit where you're taking the area of a shape, and you're going to divide it by the area of, like, the dartboard.
Okay. Well, so walk maybe the less geometry savvy among us through how dartboard addresses this.
Okay. So in this project, students get to choose from 22 shapes. They choose 6 shapes. They then cut out the shapes, the prearranged shapes, and trace them on an 11 by 17 inch sheet of paper.
Okay. So far, so good.
So that is your dartboard. And then students measure the dimensions of each of the 6 shapes and calculate the areas of those shapes.
Okay. And then thinking about what we normally think of as a dartboard, this does not sound like the typical dartboard that we'd see on a wall. So where does probability come in?
So then we had students drop objects onto the dartboard that they placed on the floor at random intervals. So they would just drop 100 objects and count how many landed in each shape. And that's where the problem became, because it's really hard to drop randomly. And so one time, 3 years ago, I had a group of 3 students who started running around my class, dropping their darts. And my initial reaction was stop, and I yelled at the kids. And then they calmly came up to me and said, oh, but Mrs. Moslake, we are trying to keep it more random, and if we're just dropping the objects, it's not really random. And I was amazed by their brilliance. So I let them continue to run, and they had a better randomness than my other students. However, this created a need to do something different because I could not have students run around my room.
Especially holding darts.
Well, the darts are really either little cubes or paper clips.
Okay. So these are metaphorical darts.
Yes.
but you didn't want them necessarily running around the classroom.
That's correct. So I thought this has to be done electronically. We have to be able to do this using technology, and there has to be some way to do it. And so I decided this would be really easy to do in GeoGebra. Now, GeoGebra is a free online math program, and you can take a picture of your dartboard, import it in a file that the students create, and then put a code for a random dot generator. My issue was I don't know how to code in GeoGebra. So I went to Steve Phelps. Steve Phelps is a math teacher in Ohio, and I follow him on Twitter. And I know he does a lot in GeoGebra and Desmos and teaches stats, AP stats, and calculus. So I emailed him at school and asked him, can you help me create a random point generator of 100 dots in GeoGebra? Within 30 minutes, he responded with the solution, gave me steps of programming this, and I was so thankful for him, and I just tweaked it for my project, and that was the wonderful part of this, is that it wasn't working doing the drops by hand, the dartboard, but doing it in technology was amazing.
The students must have been a little disappointed that they could no longer run around the classroom.
Yes.
Well, as I said, it has been a few years since I took geometry, and I will sadly admit that I don't know how well all of those lessons stuck from the 1980s. But generally speaking, how have those kinds of skills, geometric probability in particular, typically been taught before you focused on developing this?
Pretty much by hand. So students would, if they're looking at geometric probability, they would take a sheet of paper, they would calculate the area of, let's say there is a circular shape in a rectangle. You would measure the rectangle, find the area of that rectangle, measure the area of the circle, and divide the area of the circle by the area of the rectangle. And that's how we start our lesson, is get the students to understand the concept of what is geometric probability. Do you subtract? Do you multiply? Do you divide? You divide. And that helps them to understand the concept, the original concept first.
Well, and so aside from winning this impressive award, what's the evidence that, Dartboard is working? How are students taking to it, aside from running around the classroom?
Okay, so students are now coding, and that is amazing. I have a quote from a student saying that programming was challenging at first, and then I learned that it matters how I type in a code. It needs to be exact. But once I figured that out, it was cool to see that I made a random point generator.
Well, and so I wonder whether this lesson is part of a bigger picture for you in terms of how you connect students with math.
It is, because looking at the initial dropping the darts, it made the students kind of understand the concept of randomness and an experimental probability versus the theoretical probability on paper. However, the experimental probability values were not very close to the theoretical probability values because students couldn't drop randomly. So now with the computer aided help with GeoGebra and doing the coding of making that random point generator, students now can see how close an experimental probability can be to the theoretical probability. They also see the more they do the experiments, like if they do multiple experiments, that average is going to be really close to the theoretical probability. So they're understanding relationships between mathematical concepts so much better now because of the technology.
Well, and so along those lines, what is the case that you make when students or their parents invariably ask, how will this class affect my real life?
Excellent question. One of the things I also wanted to change in this probability project was incorporating more technology, but you don't just do it to do it. So you can check it off and say, well, because you're going to have to use technology in the future. It came through my mistakes in the classroom, seeing these kids running around in my class, something's going wrong. And when they were running around, it took them almost the whole period to drop 100 objects randomly because they kept missing the dart board. So there's kind of like you have to be able to create a need for technology. You have to have students see that need first in order to understand the usefulness of technology. So another part of this project that I've changed is incorporating Google spreadsheets. And once we had students create their own GeoGebra files with 100 random points, we had them look at one particular object in, let's say, a circle in that dart, and all of them used a random point generator and counted the number of dots they had out of 100. So what I had the students do is add up all of their numbers out of like 30 students and then divide by 30 to get the average. Unfortunately, there were like 5 different answers because we're all typing in like something wrong on the calculator. At that time is when I show this Google spreadsheet, I put those numbers in and I just put the easy equals average and it's done. And now we know the correct answer. And the kids are just like, oh, whoa, that was fast. And so seeing that need of how important technology can help us make it more efficient and correct is really cool for student learning.
Well, so think back to when you were learning this. What made the difference for you? Why did you connect so strongly with math as a whole and maybe geometry in particular?
Geometry lets you see the beauty of mathematics, and it can be really fun. So with these projects, students are not just sitting at their desks, but they're also collaborating with each other. And I won't always give them the answer. I'll say, I'm your boss. Go talk to your colleague. You know, go talk to your other peer. And then collaborate. See if you guys can come up with an answer. Then bother the boss. But don't bother the boss every 5 minutes. And so I'm trying to teach them emotional intelligence through these projects, which is so fun for me to see them develop as individuals and as adults.
And this is really right. It sounds like it's about far more than just the mathematical skills. You're kind of giving them human being skills.
Absolutely. And that is one of my focus points in these projects. And I tell them at the beginning of the year, we're going to do 4 sets of projects this year, and you are going to learn better skills for the workplace. You're going to learn about emotional intelligence. You're going to learn how to struggle productively, and you will struggle on these and enjoy that struggle because you will eventually learn what I want you to learn.
When did you find out you won this award?
December.
And how?
It was in an email. And at first, when I applied for the prize, it was at the end of the school year when I had just finished this probability project. And I was so excited about how it turned out and how students were learning and excited about wanting to take a coding class. And so I applied, and when I was in the middle of the summer, when I was in Yellowstone, I got an email from them saying that I was one of the top people in their pool, and I was really excited then. So from that time, middle of July to December, I continued to communicate with them. I had to update the project, make it so that it would work for middle school students as well as high school students as well.
And then you found out in December that it was your project that won.
And I was shocked because I had never thought I would be the number one winner of this prize.
And to collect this award, you get to go to New York for a whole ceremony and presumably to visit the Museum of Mathematics.
Yes, which is on my bucket list. So any mathematician, any math teacher definitely wants to go to the National Museum of Mathematics in New York City. It looks so much fun. And so teachers, math teachers in Twitterland are always taking pictures of themselves on the bike with the square wheels. And that is like the coolest thing ever.
So and this will be you shortly.
I am looking forward to that.
Had you calculated the probability that you would win this award?
It was very low.
and it comes with a fairly hefty monetary prize, which has to make a pretty big difference in the life of a teacher.
Yes, it's quite an honor. It is shocking. It's wonderful.
Well, Elizabeth Moslick, thank you so much. Congratulations. And I hope we'll have a chance to talk again down the road.
Thank you.
Enjoy New York.
Okay, thank you so much.
Elizabeth Moslick teaches geometry at Cedarburg High School. Tomorrow in New York, she'll receive the 2018 Rosenthal Prize for Innovation in Math Teaching at the National Museum of Mathematics. You can see a picture of her award-winning dartboard lesson at WUWM.com.
How cold is too cold when it comes to exercising outdoors? Our Fit for You segment takes on that issue when Lake Effect continues in a moment on 89.7 WUWM.
It's Lake Effect. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. Wisconsin has been hit hard this winter, from snowstorms to a polar vortex that brought dangerously cold temperatures and wind chills to the area. But even on the coldest days, temperatures falling well below zero, you'll see a few dedicated runners or bikers who've skipped the gym and are exercising outdoors.
Experts say frigid temperatures can increase your chances of cold weather injuries, from frostbite and hypothermia to aggravating heart, lung, and circulation issues. But even if we layer up properly, how cold is too cold when it comes to exercising outdoors in the winter?
Dr. Sandra Hunter says that's a tricky question. Hunter is a professor in exercise science at the Marquette Department of Physical Therapy and a faculty fellow in the Office of Research and Innovation.
Hunter did not brave the cold, but instead joined Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski by phone for this month's Fit for You. Hunter explains there are several factors to consider before you decide to suit up and exercise outside, and it's not as simple as temperature.
They really fit into preparedness, environmental factors, and also individual characteristics of the person. So preparedness, particularly clothing choices and hydration and food intake. Environmental factors, what I mean by that is that although the air temperature can be a certain temperature, there's certainly wind chill can lower the experience for the person exercising. And also there's individual characteristics of the person exercising, because we know that some people are more at risk of cold weather injuries, particularly older adults, children, and also women, as well as those who have conditions that will predispose them in terms of health, such as those who have asthma or heart disease.
So when it comes to deciding what's right, I know as a general rule, if it's warmer than 5 degrees outside, chances of frostbite are relatively low. But you mentioned proper clothing. What kind of layers should we do if we do intend on exercising outdoors with the plethora of sport performance gear that's especially available today versus just layering up on cotton sweaters and T-shirts back when they didn't develop these clothes?
Yeah, so with clothing, and that's probably that catches people most off guard. What you're actually wanting to do here is protect against cold weather injuries, which is hypothermia and frostbite. And lack of preparation in terms of clothing is probably one of the biggest factors that will predispose people to that type of injury. And you mentioned there's certainly different types of clothing, but the advice is that you have at least three layers, an internal layer that allows evaporation of sweat without absorption. And that can that should be a layer that's in direct contact with the skin. And it should be a moisture wicking material such as polyester or polypropylene, certainly not cotton, which doesn't do that well as a fabric to take away the moisture. A middle layer, which really should provide the insulation, and that middle layer, such as fleece or wool, and then an external layer, which is resistant against wind and water, but also allows evaporation of the moisture. So you want zippers and ventilating abilities for the clothing. So those sorts of, you stick to that sort of general rule of three layers. You can really exercise in most fairly actually cold temperatures, even well below zero. And it really can protect you. And if you think about exercise, exercise is actually a countermeasure to preventing hypothermia. And so, but if you do it in the with the right clothing, then you're really going to protect yourself and you're going to be able to exercise in pretty low temperatures.
Now, when it comes to preparing our clothes, that's very important. But what do you want to emphasize when it comes to changing out of your clothes post-workout? I know, you know, some people may even be going to the gym and stay in those clothes, even if they're going outside in the cold weather to their car and on the drive home. How important is it to change out of those wet clothes post-workout?
Changing out of wet clothes in particular, particularly if you've been sweating, is actually really important because it's that sweating and that evaporation, which will actually lower your body temperature. So getting into some dry, warm clothes after a workout, particularly if you're going out into the cold temperatures, is actually really important. And you've got to remember what your body's really trying to keep a body temperature, which is around about 98 degrees. And anything that allows it or exposes your body to a drop in temperature puts it at risk of hypothermia, which we sort of class as anything about 95 degrees or below, will really put your body in danger of not performing well. So exercising, sweating, and then going out to the cold temperatures is going to put you at risk at that.
What are some of the symptoms of hypothermia and even frostbite that people should be aware of and look out for? And what kind of symptoms occur when it's too late?
Oh, good question. One of the first symptoms is shivering. And, you know, that's your body's natural response to trying to keep your body warm. And that is, you know, trying to generate metabolic heat. And you also lose fine motor control. When it gets really severe, you can lose large motor control. You can start to slur your speech. And eventually, when hypothermia becomes really severe, you can go into cardiac arrest and obviously into a coma, very severe. But severe shivering would be something that would you'd want to be looking for. When you start to shiver, you know your body's trying to fight off the cold and trying to keep your core body temperature at that nice 98 degrees. That's hypothermia. The other risk is frostbite, which is really, it's a really interesting response of the body. What happens when your body gets cold, the vessels, particularly in the periphery, in your fingers, your hands, your feet, your arms start to constrict and they narrow. And that's the body's response to try and shunt that warm blood to the core to keep your body temperature at that nice regulated 98, 99 degrees. And so what happens is the extremities, particularly your fingers and your hands and also your ears and your nose, if exposed, can start to freeze, and the water within the periphery and within the cells, within the skin and just under the skin, can start to freeze, and that's when you get frostbite. So exposing bare skin to extreme temperatures, particularly when there's a wind chill, is to be avoided. So putting on gloves and just, you know, masks when you're out in the cold to try and prevent that. And but certainly one of the first signs with frostbite is that your fingers start to feel painful, and also that they start to go numb. And they're sort of signs to look for.
When it comes to recognizing these warning signs, I'm curious, when you're outside, you're exercising, your heart rate is elevated, and you're feeling the adrenaline of whatever activity you're doing, does it take you longer to recognize these warning signs because your body is in a heightened state?
Yeah, it certainly can. But in fact, exercise is actually a countermeasure to the cold temperatures. So exercise can actually prevent hypothermia. But if you're exercising and you're not taking care of your fingers and your fingers are sweating but progressively getting cold, yes, you can actually get frostbite and almost ignore it and not even know that it's occurring, you know, just ignoring the numbness. And there's actually quite a high rate of frostbite that does occur in, you know, Nordic skiers and who are quite at risk of getting frostbite. Even I've seen some studies up to 20 to 30% of people who commonly go out and exercise, you know, in Nordic skiing, et cetera, can get frostbite, which I think is actually amazing.
Yeah, that's a very surprising statistic that I wouldn't have thought about.
Yeah.
Now, when it comes to the cold and our muscles, you know, even if you're not outdoors exercising, you're shivering, keeping your body warm, those muscles are contracting. What is happening specifically to our muscles in this extreme cold, whether we are exercising indoors, outdoors, or not?
Well, your body is generating a lot of heat. And when you exercise, your metabolic heat can be at least doubled, and depending on the exercise, up to four times the heat generation that would normally occur at rest. In the cold, that still occurs, but one of the hallmarks of exercising in particularly cold weather is that the rate that your muscle contracts at is slower. And so you can get a slowing of muscle contraction. And also, studies have found that it costs more energy to exercise in the cold.
When it comes to exercising outdoors, walking outdoors, shoveling, obviously we are feeling the cold in our very lungs. You know, we're breathing that cold air and we have that chilling sensation. Is there a greater risk of heart and lung damage, especially if perhaps you already have symptoms of bad circulation or asthma, things of the such?
Certainly people who are at risk of heart disease and asthma should be really careful exercising in the cold. And it's also now established that there's a higher rate of heart attacks, myocardial infarction, particularly in men, after heavy snowfalls. And that's associated with snow shoveling. And I think there's several reasons for that. One is that snow shoveling can really certainly raise your heart rate and blood pressure more quickly and certainly more dramatically than other types of exercises. Also, the snow shoveling really requires the use of arms, which for most people is more strenuous than other exercise. Obviously, you know, there's the cold environment, and with the constriction of the blood vessels with the cold temperatures, that can certainly predispose to some type of injury like that. But probably one of the main factors in combination with these other factors is that often the shovelers are typically sedentary. And so suddenly they're asking their bodies to perform this intense exercise in the upper body, which creates greater strain on the body and greater increases in heart rate and blood pressure. And so it just predisposes them to more heart attacks. So particularly if you've got some underlying disease process going on already.
Now, Wisconsinites were hardy people, and you mentioned you can exercise safely as long as you take the proper precautions, even if it's below zero outside. But what would you say is a good range of degrees? I would say including wind chill. You know, what number, what below a number is not safe, even for the most practiced and elite of athletes to be outside?
It's really hard to answer because I'm so dependent on the person. I know you're trying to find a number. That, you know, if you think about, certainly, I mean, certainly preparedness. And if everyone's prepared and everyone's healthy, to give an exact number, I think would actually be irresponsible of me. Because the wind chill can just change it so markedly. And, you know, there's those charts, the U.S. National Weather Service that they put out that I'm sure everyone's been looking at over the last few days of how the wind chill can just dramatically drop the temperature. And there's also the individual characteristics that older people, children, women are much more at risk. And the reason is, for hypothermia, the reason being that they've got less muscle mass, so they've got less ability for that metabolic heat to be generated. That's number one. Number two is that often, smaller people, women, older adults, children, typically have a larger surface area to body mass ratio. And so they're much more likely to lose heat more quickly than someone who has a smaller ratio, that usually being men. And that, doubled with the effect of men having more muscle mass, where they've got the ability to generate more heat because they've got more muscle, puts women and older adults and children more at risk of losing heat. So what might be appropriate for someone, you know, a male, may be quite different for a child. So it does differ with individual characteristics, as well as obviously being prepared and the environmental factors.
Well, I hope people certainly take this advice to heart to avoid any unnecessary injuries and illnesses this winter. Sandra Hunter, thank you so much for lending us some of your knowledge on this topic today.
Yes, thank you so much.
Dr. Sandra Hunter is a professor in exercise science at the Marquette University Department of Physical Therapy. She spoke with Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski for this month's Fit for You segment. You can find more information about cold weather exercising and explore more Fit for You segments at WUWM.com. That's all for today's edition of the show. I'm Mitch Tite.
And I'm Bonnie North. Thanks so much for tuning in, and I hope you'll be with us again tomorrow at 10 for another edition of Lake Effect on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.
Keep listening. It's 11 o'clock, and fresh air is next.